It's the 7th of May, 2024. As the year goes on and filling up the calendar with various happenings and events in the monastery, I was looking for a date for this next day of practice. Last year we had a couple days of practice where it was these kind of day-long retreats in the monastery, these Anapanasati days. And looking for a date in June, and thought, oh, June 1st is going to be a good day. And then, oh, yeah, June 1st is the 28th birthday of Abhayagiri also. So we can roll that into the theme somehow. So we're maturing. The monastery is aging. And we think about the Buddha. The Buddha was either 28 or 29 when he went forth. We say 29, but actually, the way it's written or said is that he was in his 29th year, which would mean he was 28 by our standards. So he was either 28 or 29. So there's that sense of an age, reaching an age of a certain maturation. And the Buddha going forth at that age, going forth from the household life into homelessness. And this is a very quiet time at Abhayagiri. There was a lot of planning taking place for Thanajan Jayasaro's visit, and the visit happened and it went well. And I traveled with him up to Portland, and we spent some time at Pacific Hermitage with Ajahn Sudanto and Tancha Tapalo, Tanda Mawaro. And then we parted ways again, and I stayed there, Pacific Hermitage, a couple days by myself, and then came back, and now it's very quiet. So I actually really like and appreciate these quiet times at Abhayagiri. And it's sitting in the dining hall by myself at tea time, just listening to the crickets, and then listening to the crickets during the meditation. I find it very, very peaceful, exquisite even. And just that's one technique for making the mind peaceful, is actually just listening to the sounds of nature and just being outside and the perfect weather, perfect temperature. And it's not always so easy to tap into this silence, though. So it's like an acquired taste. It's acquiring a taste for quietude, acquiring a taste for solitude. But then once we connect with it, that's the Samana Dhamma, cultivation of solitude. That's in the Sutta Nipata. The solitude is called sagacity. Cultivation of solitude is the contemplative's task. And it's interesting living here at Abhayagiri. We're a big community living together, doing a fair number of communal activities. But we're also like hermits. We're like a group of hermits who live together and do communal activities. We eat together, but then we disperse and we live on our own. So it's that cultivation of solitude. And then some people are on forest practice and won't have to come to pujas over the next period of time. And so to use that time skillfully, to really try to use that time skillfully, really get in touch with the quietude of the forest. And then when we get in touch with the quietude of the forest, just developing that perception of being in the forest and being away from a lot of people, and then we can develop this quality of pamoja, which is a sense of deep contentment, a sense of delight in solitude. And I really think that's one of the most important foundations of meditation, is that sense of deep contentment where we can just sit and we're not intensively focusing on a meditation object. We're not intensively focusing on a meditation object, but there is joy and the mind settles naturally based on that joy. And then can we sit out in nature by ourselves and actually experience a deep solace of being in the forest? And that's also I believe it's in the Suttanipata where the Buddha is talking about is going forth, the Pabbaja Sutta, that going forth from the home life into homelessness and leaving all the trappings of palace life and the life of opulence and being by himself, yeah, the Bodhisatta, being by himself, going alms round and experiencing for the first time the alms round and eating out of a bowl, wearing rag robes, and then living in the forest by himself and experiencing great solace in being in the forest. And so this is one part of Buddha Anusati. It can be very helpful to reflect on these things, imagine these things. Even if we have a visual mind, we can visualize these things. And we're not really going to experience Pamoja without those foundations of sila and having a daily meditation practice. So we really need to focus on those precepts and conduct. Hiriyotapa, the cultivation of Hiriyotapa. And that really needs to be cultivated over time. I think for myself, it took a long time to cultivate that sense of Hiriyotapa. It didn't just come naturally to me. And I know there's various times in my own monastic life where I've frittered the time away or wasted time, and that I can see now that that was due to a lack of Hiriyotapa. But then over time, and just with experience, then that Hiriyotapa becomes a very necessary quality to really keep going long-term in the monastic life. Yeah. And Longpu Man would call those the protectors of the world, Hiri and Otapa, which is like a sense of conscience and acknowledgement of the results of wrongdoing, the harmful results of wrongdoing. So sometimes when we meditate, various hindrances come up, and there might be pain in the back, pain in the knees, might have a headache, or there's some sort of pain in the body, and there are various things we can do about this. And we might feel a sense of tiredness, drowsiness when we meditate. And when we stop meditating, the energy might come back. These are various hindrances that can arise in the meditation. And it's good to reflect on just how powerful the mind is and how much the mind has an effect on the body. So when the Buddha is talking about qualities like Pamoja, those things are experienced in the body, sensed in the body. And that's when the mind becomes very, very wholesome. And it is actually felt in the body. It's sensed in the body. We might feel a burning sensation at the heart center or just feel a relaxed joy throughout the body. And the opposite is also true, that when there's various hindrances, we might feel a little bit more pain in the body, a little bit more agitation, restlessness, restless energy, agitated energy in the body. And when there's some sort of pain, it's very interesting that reflection I've had as of late is that it seems to be that the mind has more to do with pains in the body than we tend to give credit for. Of course, there are bodily pains that aren't just caused by the mind, but if the mind is wholesome, the body will tend to be quite relaxed and comfortable. And if the mind is unwholesome, the body will tend to be more agitated. And so these mental states actually have a really big part to play in how our body is doing. We just think of something like anger. It can cause us to turn red in the face, get sweaty under the armpits, all sorts of things. All sorts of physiological changes happen when we get angry. Or that can be the same with desire as well. And so when the mind gets very wholesome, there are also physiological changes. It's very interesting just to think about this, reflect on it. And the body can become very, very comfortable in that sense of joy, of Pamoja, be felt in the body. And then practice is wonderful. Everything's wonderful. Everybody's wonderful when we're in those states. And then when the mind becomes unwholesome, then things aren't so wonderful. The community's not so wonderful. Maybe something is going to be the experience is going to be better somewhere else, some other time. So how do we make the mind wholesome as much as possible? One thing we can do is just listen to the crickets, just delight in that. Yeah. But again, it is an acquired taste, this quietude, solitude. If we haven't yet experienced that kind of joy, we're going to be going and seeking it elsewhere through talking, through seeking of company, or through some form of sensuality. We're going to seek happiness in those ways. Those are all very coarse compared to the happiness of solitude, compared to the happiness of just wholesome mental states leading to a comfortable and relaxed bodily sensations. So there's not so much to say about it, just that it's something we have to try out, something we have to acquire a taste for, and something we need to, if we want to develop these samana dhammas, then something we really do need to put effort into. We can try doing walking meditation for longer periods of time. So I've been reading this Longpo Jia biography and just getting inspired to do walking meditation, inspired to do more asubha practice. And if anybody who reads through that book will find that he has various skillful ways and interesting ideas about how to do asubha practice, visualizations. And he's actually, the part I just got to where he's dissecting his hands joint by joint, so and visualizing that. Things like that, we have to get creative with the practice. It's going to be incredibly helpful. Or these stories about Longpo Man, Ajahn Man, where he's just giving very brief teachings, just and also teaching by example, just by his own ability to endure sickness and pain, and just an example of someone who is aging very gracefully. Longpo Jia was living with Ajahn Man. As Ajahn Man was later in his life, so he was aging and his physical faculties were declining and his mental faculties were starting to decline, but it wasn't a problem. And these are just natural occurrences of the body and mind, as we're just a part of nature, so we're no different than anything else in nature. It just subsists for a while and then it declines. It's always changing. We think about a Bayagiri, almost 28 years old. It's changed a lot in that time, from its infancy to coming of age. It's changed a lot. So for people who came here in the first or second year, if they were to not come this whole time and then come here now, it'd be unrecognizable. And where I'm sitting right now was there was an old power pole right here. It was an old power pole, and it was just a dirt patch, and this is where we used to hang up laundry, right here where I'm sitting right now. It's just, we wouldn't even be able to imagine that. There's no evidence of that. Yeah. So just how things change and how things just disappear. There's no trace. There's no trace remains. No evidence remains except our memories, some photos. And just where the breezeway is, there was an apple tree. We had to take it out to build this building. The deer were really disappointed. They're kind of, where's my apple tree? They would come and eat the apples when they came out. And we talked with Luke Fry at Fry Vineyards about the possibility of transplanting the apple tree. It's a very old apple tree. And he said that if you're going to transplant it, you have to carefully use a excavator to dig up the whole tree without damaging the roots too much, and then to, if you're going to put it somewhere else, then to make sure it's oriented the same direction that it was. But alas, it wasn't to be. But we did cut up the wood, and apple wood is very beautiful wood, so we were able to make use of that for various projects. We also had a cherry tree that had to be taken down, but I think it was so old it didn't produce cherries anymore. And the cherry tree had to be cut down for the building of this building. And cherry wood, we were able to make use of that wood as well. Also very nice, very good hardwood. But when I was in Anagarika, it was still producing cherries. And then at a certain point, the tree got so old, it wasn't producing anymore. It was still alive, but it didn't bear fruit anymore. And I remember I used to go and collect the cherries as an Anagarika and then make my super desserts that I wanted to make as an Anagarika. chocolate brownies with cherries in them from that cherry tree. But there's no evidence of that now. You can't even see where it was. The apple tree, the cherry tree, they're gone. And new trees come up. There's, I was looking at the plans for this whole building in this area one day, and on architectural plans, you have to note where trees are. So these plans were about 20 years old, original schematics for what we were going to do in this area. And there's markings for where some trees were. And then there's this one tree. It's an oak tree, and it wasn't on the map. It wasn't on the map. Oh, why wasn't that tree on the map? I was talking with Debbie about it. And that tree was just a sapling when the map was made, so they don't put saplings on the map, but now it's a big tree, so now it would be on the map. So it wasn't on the map because it was just a little sprout when the map was made. Now it's this big tree. Now it's 25 feet tall, 30 feet tall. So even though trees grow slowly, still, over time, they do grow tall. They do get big and strong. They do. It takes time. And we just go about our lives, and those trees do eventually get big, and they grow from a sapling up into a big, solid tree with heartwood. And so it's the same with wholesome qualities. You know, it takes time, and we just keep going on with our practice, keep cultivating the sila, keep doing the daily meditation. You know, eventually, we're going to develop some heartwood. Eventually, there's going to be some essence, and eventually the tree will grow and bear fruit. So it's good just to recollect that, to remember that. And one of the themes that came up in Portland that people were asking about was the theme of metta, and metta for oneself. And this also is something that needs to be cultivated over a long period of time. We really need to gain insight into how to do this. So any of these qualities, we really need to penetrate and not necessarily do it. At first, it's going to be superficial. We're just going to recite phrases and try to do what the suttas say, do what the Buddha says in kind of a superficial way. But then you talk about something like metta for oneself, and we try to wish ourselves well. We do these phrases, may I abide in well-being, and so on. But do we really mean it? And to have metta for ourselves and to have metta for others, we really need to mean it. We really need to genuinely be wishing well for ourselves. We really need to be genuinely wishing well for others. And this is something that comes with time. Maybe we're not ready to genuinely wish ourselves well. Maybe we're not ready to genuinely wish others well. And part of it, too, is that we need to see, you know, what sort of obstructions are in the mind. Why can't we do this? And then as we develop more experience, then, and the mind starts to get more wholesome and more stable and strong, and we develop a little bit of power in our practice. So at first the practice doesn't have any power. It's just kind of flimsy and weak. And then over time it starts to develop power, and we really have that hero tapa. We really start to see the drawback of the unwholesome mental states and really start to put more effort into relinquishing them, really start to mean it when we practice, really start to put our heart into it. So then we'll be able to even do things, not just have metta for ourselves, but have metta for enemies, which the Buddha talks about as well. So normally we do put a lot of emphasis into having metta for ourselves or metta for loved ones, people who it's easy to think positively of. But then I think it's the most important form of metta, to be able to have goodwill, genuine goodwill, and actually spread goodwill to those who are a threat to us, who have irritated us, who have wronged us in some way. So in the it's actually in the Dasi Me Akasi Me, the chant that we do for the departed, if there's a meal offering on behalf of the departed, this Adasi Me Akasi Me chant, part of the meaning of that is, you know, one who holds on to thoughts such as they harmed me, they wronged me, they hurt me, one who holds on to thoughts such as that is bound for hell. And so, yes, there may be people who genuinely have harmed us, wronged us, hurt us, mistreated us in some way, or we may have been privy to some sort of injustice, either towards ourselves or we've seen it towards others. And to have genuine goodwill for those people, that's the test. That's the test of if we're reaching maturity in our practice, if we're able to do that. And that's the type of thing that has power to end conflict. It has the power to really change things for the better. So if we can have genuine goodwill for those who are a threat, that's very powerful. That's something that, kind of a topic of discussion that was coming up in Portland with the groups there. So just some reflections on just how things change over time. The cultivation of Hiriyotapa, how it can become strong over time, and just making note of things. It's hard to remember. It's hard to know and acknowledge how things were in the past, but it's good to reflect on it. Because in the future, say 28 years from now, things are going to be just as different again. And everything now is just going to be like everything at this moment, at this spot, was 28 years ago. We're not going to remember it. So that's one part of mindfulness, just taking stock of acknowledging, you know, 28 years from now, you know, Tan Obasi will be almost 30 vasas. Yeah, imagine that. Or I'll be in my 70s. I'll be as old as Lungpar Pisano is now. Ajahn Chunda will be almost 80 at that time. And he'll probably still be full of energy also at that time. And then there's that timeless quality of just listening to the silence, listening to the crickets. That's something that doesn't seem to change. Listening to the crickets now was the same as 28 years ago. So these are just a few reflections as things kind of settle down after the Ajahn Jayasuro visit. And it's just to give encouragement to make use of this quiet time, develop some cultivation of solitude, some of these samana dhammas. So I'll leave it there for this evening.